This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Mohammed Khalil from the University of Illinois Department of Religion, where he teaches courses on Islam. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. How long have you been on campus now?
About a year and a half now.
And before that, your PhD was from the University of Michigan?
That's right.
And how long did that take you? It took me a long time to get that degree.
You know, actually, I was very fortunate because I did my undergraduate and my master's degrees, my undergraduate studies and my master's degree at the University of Michigan. So I actually completed the PhD within a period of about, about maybe 2 years.
So. Goodness. Many people here are very impressed. I might explain to our listening audience that we do have a studio audience today. We're recording this as a part of a class on Islam at something called OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, and it's headed up by Kathleen Holder. She's here in the studio with us today, or in the class. And Kathleen, tell us a little bit about OLLI. What is OLLI? How did it get started, and what do you do?
Well, OLLI is a member-run organization. Our members pay a fee, and for that fee, then they tell me what to do. Almost all of the time, they tell me what to do. Some of them are looking askance at one another. We started out in our first semester was in the fall of 2007, and we had 200 members at that time. We now have over 500, and it's a wonderful place where people can come together and learn as a learning community, learn all kinds of things like Islam, politics, art, science. I should actually let your listening group here talk about it because they're much more eloquent than I am.
But now, there are some restrictions. I mean, not just anybody can become a member and take classes.
Yeah, you do have to be over 50.
You have to be over 50 years of age.
Uh-huh. And okay. It's funded by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Mr. Osher believes that the traditional lifelong learning programs really shortchanged older adults in that they didn't acknowledge the need for older adults to be able to take intellectually stimulating courses. And I think we have found that here, that that our members, we certainly wouldn't have grown like this if we hadn't been able to tap into that, I think, an unmet need.
Well, thank you for talking to us and the listening audience about Osher, and we'll let you get back to running things, and we'll continue our conversation with our guest today. Thank you. Kathleen Holder, director of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute here at the University of Illinois. If you'd like to learn more about it, there is a website you can go to, just plug that in your search engine, and you'll find it. And the classes are listed there online, or you may call OLLI at the University of Illinois. But getting back to our guest with Professor Khalil talking about Islam in this particular class that's meeting 8 times with different guests who are practicing Muslims talking about their faith, and in this case, a Muslim scholar. Mohammed, how important are scholars in the tradition of Islam?
Very important. And in fact, there are different kinds of scholars. You have, in the Muslim world, generally speaking, I would say 3 general categories of scholars. First, you have those who are trained in traditional institutions and have attained diplomas or certificates that put them in a position where they can actually issue fatwas. Now, we hear the term fatwa, and what's the common definition? A death sentence, right? Okay, as I told my class just yesterday, actually, the term fatwa has nothing to do with death. The term fatwa simply means a non-binding, yet legitimizing, legal opinion. That's all a fatwa is. And the reason why we think it means death sentence is because at the end of the 80s, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa stating that Salman Rushdie, the famous author, should be killed. Now, for those Muslims who do not recognize Ayatollah Khomeini's authority, they would not really care necessarily that he issued this fatwa.
And Rushdie is still alive.
And Rushdie is still alive, that's right. And I know many Muslims who've actually interacted with him just fine. So it's a fatwa is simply a non-binding, yet legitimizing so long as you accept the authority of the individual issuing the fatwa. Okay, and this is, of course, where you're going to find a lot of differences. And, of course, you know, needless to say, Islam does not have a pope. And so you're going to have really a plurality of views, whether you're talking about theological issues, legal issues, all kinds of issues. And this, of course, raises the question of who speaks for Islam. And ultimately, the answer that we find in the history of Islam is the community speaks on behalf of Islam as a whole. And one can certainly find some interesting parallels here to Judaism, where you have a rabbi, for example, who may issue legal, who may be a guide and also may issue legal statements and so on. So going back to what I was saying, you have three kinds of scholars. You have the first kind who issues fatwas and is regarded as really sort of a master of the Islamic sciences, if we may call it that. A second type of scholar is someone who is also traditionally trained to some extent and is not necessarily regarded as a legal expert per se, but someone who provides general guidance, someone who answers questions that people may have, but does not necessarily, you know, if there's a debate over stem cell research, this kind of scholar will not get involved in that debate, okay? Whereas the first kind of scholar might, okay? So that's the second type, more of a pastor type scholar, if you will. The third type of scholar is someone who is trained in has an academic background. Maybe this is a Western academic background. Maybe this is in the Muslim world. Someone who is trained, for example, at one of the major universities there. And this kind of scholar is very different and may or may not be accepted by the larger Muslim community. I suppose it ultimately depends on what they have to say. So those are three general categories of scholars. There may be others that I'm overlooking right now, but those are three very basic types.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I might just explain to listeners, radio listeners, that you cannot call in for this program because it has been pre-recorded, as I mentioned. But we do have 50 or more folks in the classroom here at Ali, and I've invited them to ask questions. And so we already have one person who's come up to the microphone. So let's have your comment or question, please.
Yes, Professor. The Quran, in several passages, says there shall be no compulsion with regard to religion. But down through the centuries, in some Muslim countries, there have been special restrictions on non-Muslims. There have been special taxes, restrictions on where they could live and how they practice their religion. I'm wondering if what's your view of those types of restrictions? Are they current now in some Muslim countries?
That's a very good question. It's a complex question also because, you know, actually I was just talking about this very topic with my students last week, and I was saying, you know, imagine 500 years from now, someone decides to study American history and the treatment of minorities in America. And even if you just focus on the African-American context, you would really have, it'd be very difficult to generalize. And so when people say under Islam, non-Muslims had it good, or non-Muslims had it bad, I think we have to, both are problematic, both are fictions. And I'm not saying you were saying that, I'm just saying that's a general statement that you'll hear. Both are fictions. And in the history of Islam, you find that it's a complex development. If you look at the example of the Prophet Muhammad, during his lifetime, you have instances where, for example, when he first moves to Medina and he establishes what's called the Constitution or Covenant or Treaty of Medina, this was a treaty that basically involved Muslims, pagans, and I'm using pagan in the academic sense, not to be derogatory, and Jews. And this was an arrangement whereby each side basically agreed to live essentially in harmony and to defend one another. And the only stipulation that was different or maybe something that was positive from the Muslim perspective was that it said that if there were ever any disputes, that Muhammad would be the arbiter. And the reason why this treaty was signed was that there had been a civil war prior to this. And according to the reports that we have, the people in Medina had invited Muhammad to be the arbiter. That's what we have in the sources. And so we have this arrangement. We also have an arrangement whereby you have battles. And after the battle, you have a situation where those who had just been defeated were expected to pay a tax, what's called a jizya tax. The jizya tax was a poll tax, and it was regarded historically as a defense tax. The idea being that those who had just been defeated would not be expected to fight with the army, and so they would pay this jizya tax. And in the history of Islam, you find instances where a particular caliph, a ruler, would feel that the Muslims had not done a sufficient job defending the non-Muslim populace, and so they return the jizya payment back to them. In other instances, you find the opposite. In other instances, you find caliphs who charge non-Muslims a really, ridiculous amount, and you have unusual regulations with regard to non-Muslims. Non-Muslims, for example, were expected to wear distinctive clothing. If a church was destroyed or something, they could not rebuild it. But you also have the opposite of that. So you really have both in the history of Islam. You have instances where you find positive interactions. I mean, when the Muslims first spread, there's this idea that there was forced conversion, for example, and that non-Muslims were persecuted in ways that were unusual for that era. And in point of fact, we find reports that could support both, that could support that and that could refute that. In terms of forced conversion, we know that, in fact, there was no forced conversion as a general practice. You certainly had exceptions, though. But as far as general practice goes, we know that that was not the case. And there was actually a very interesting study by a professor at Columbia named Richard Bullitt. The professor is named Richard Bullitt. And he has a study on conversion in early Islam. And what he does is he looks at biographical dictionaries. That is, he looks at the evolution of names in the Muslim world. And his conclusion is that it took about 2 to 3 centuries to get to the point where half the population was Muslim. And so his argument then is that there was no forced conversion as a general practice. And in fact, one of the strongest arguments to support this is the existence to this day of Egyptian Christians, for example, Yemeni Jews, and so on. Now, as far as the treatment of non-Muslims in general, as I say, you really have both. I mean, when the Muslims first spread and you have the Umayyad dynasty, you had non-Muslims who were still part of the administration, working for the caliph, in pretty high up positions. You also have, I mean, one thing to keep in mind also is this, and that is that when you compare the treatment of non-Muslims in the Muslim world to Muslims in the non-Muslim world at that time, one could say that there was a relative degree of tolerance in the Muslim world. I mean, if one thinks about, the following, you could be a Jew in Iraq, a Christian in Cairo, a Jew in Yemen, a Zoroastrian in Baghdad, but you could not necessarily be a Muslim in London, Paris, or even the Chesapeake Bay for a long period of time. It's quite complex. It's quite complex, yeah.
Thank you for the question. That's very helpful. Let me ask another question, if I might, to tie in with something we were talking about before you came today, which was the problem of translating the Quran from the Arabic, which we've come to understand is the only authentic version of the Quran, into other languages, such as English. And we've looked at a couple translations and some of the differences between them. And this is What I'm handing you now is just one of the couple sentences, long sentences, but a couple sentences about Allah being light and the image of light. And we talked about that image in Christianity and Judaism, but how do we know what translation in English we can trust? And who do we go to? Do we go to you? What to the whole community of Islam? How do we know?
The only thing I would recommend is learn Arabic, because I have yet to encounter a translation that I'm satisfied with. Every translation I've encountered, I've had a problem with. And there's some translations that might get the meaning down, but they lose the form, which is significant. I mean, probably the best translation for the, if you want to get a sense of the form of the Quran, the way it rhymes, the way it sounds, maybe Arbery, A.J. Arbery, a non-Muslim, his translation of the Quran. That gives you a sense of the form. If you're looking for the meaning of the Quran, well, I mean, what I assign to my students is a translation by a man named Abdel Halim, and that's spelled A-B-D-E-L space H-A-L-E-E-M. And this was published by Oxford University Press 2 or 3 years ago, I believe. But even that translation I have problems with. And so I don't think you should trust me or anyone, actually, because it's really, you know, a lot of, see, one of the challenges of translation is that, you know, you could have a term that is controversial. What does this term mean? And you have a lot of debate. And then when somebody translates it and then you read it, you get no sense that there was ever a debate. It almost resolves the issue for you. And so theological, there are a lot of theological assumptions and legal assumptions that go into a translation of the Quran. And for that reason, all I can say, and I know this is a frustrating response, but learning Arabic is the only response I can.
It does happen that you teach classes in Arabic, right?
Well, I used to, actually, yeah.
Fortunately, students at the university can actually take courses in Arabic.
That's right. That's right.
We have another class member who has a comment or question.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for coming, because there are a lot of people in this room, and we're very, very interested in what you can tell us. Because we have learned a lot about Islam in the newspapers lately, the last few years. And this one, this is an article that came out just Friday the 13th. Police say female suicide bomber kills 35. Now, we have learned the Sunni and Shia schism in Islam. We have, I think we're well aware that there's a long history of the Palestinian and Israeli condition where we have suicide bombers, and we recognize that. And we also, I think, understand at least our role, the United States' role in the world, and that we can be culpable for 9/11 and so forth. We understand that. Now, the part that we really don't understand is how, in a religious context of going to a site like Karbala, and a woman in this article is going to kill 35 pilgrims who are Muslims going to a sacred event. And I guess I really hard to understand what part of Islam is there that allows that within your own people murder.
Excellent. First, let me say at a personal level that I am just as confused as you as to why this would occur. This is heartbreaking, and every time I go to CNN.com and I look at the headlines, and, I mean, even just today, you'll see this, it's heartbreaking. It really is. How could someone justify this? Well, you know, I think that if we look at the issue of terrorism, in Islamic law, there is a concept of jihad. Now, what is jihad? Jihad, of course, means struggle. That's the general term. It could refer to a personal struggle. It could refer to a struggle on the battlefield, even. But, and of course, this is very shocking to some people, because the question is, how could there's could a concept of battles and fighting and so on be part of a religion in the first place? And I think here the Muslim will, at least those who are on the side of peace, will point to the context in which Islam arose, which is you have a society in which anarchy was the order of the day, in which you have essentially no concept of peace being the normal state of affairs. In fact, there were what were called the four forbidden months, and during those months you could not fight, but any other month it was considered normal. There was no sort of, it was not seen as immoral to fight at any other time. And so if you look at the example of Muhammad, the first 12 or 13 years of his mission, he's a pacifist through and through. In fact, it's forbidden for Muslims to fight during that first those first 12 or 13 years, even though some were being killed and so on. It's when he moves to Medina. And from here, when you look at the last 10 years of his life, here it ultimately depends on how you choose to view Muhammad. Do you choose to view him as being as someone who engaged in wanton violence, or do you see him as someone who was fighting for the survival of his community? Ultimately, that's going to be a judgment call, and people are going to see that very differently. And for those of us who choose to see it as an issue of survival, then what you just described is extremely problematic. There was an article actually published by my former advisor, a man named Sherman Jackson. The article is called Jihad and the Modern World, and I think you can get this online. Okay, and what he argues there is that when you look at medieval Islamic legal texts, they refer to a concept called the abode of Islam and the abode of war. And the abode of Islam were those constitutes those countries that were predominantly Muslim countries, and the abode of war constitutes what were sort of the non-Muslim countries. And what Jackson argues is that this medieval legal, these discussions, these terms, were descriptive rather than prescriptive. In other words, they were simply describing their world. The abode of Islam, as many defined it, was a place where a Muslim could practice his or her faith freely, publicly. And for them to say that there's something called the abode of war means that one could not practice their faith. And so they were being descriptive. They're not being prescriptive. Okay, that's a controversial claim. I actually buy it, but that's a controversial claim, just so you know. And so Jackson's argument is that now we're in the modern period. Now you have something called the United Nations. And we can debate how effective or ineffective it is. But you have something called the United Nations. You have something called borders. And I mean, the United States does not have to have a peace treaty with Canada to know that there is a state of peace between the two countries. It's assumed. And so now the normal state of affairs is a state of peace, in theory. And Jackson's argument is that now that we're in this context, the very concept of an aggressive jihad ceases to be viable. There's no need for it in this context. Defensive jihad, yes. If somebody attacks you, you can defend yourself. But aggressive jihad, which is sort of a preemptive attack, in a context such as ours, would not be logical, so argues Jackson. Now, as for the issue of terrorism, in Islamic law, you might find debates in the medieval period about whether it's okay to fight non-Muslim countries just because they're non-Muslim. You have people saying that, and you have others saying no, only if there's a threat. Okay, you have this debate. What you never have is a debate over whether it's okay to kill women and children haphazardly, as we saw on 9/11. You never saw that. I mean, you might occasionally get someone saying, well, what if the only way to win a battle is if, you know, they bring something innocent in front of you, and that's the only way you can win the battle is by killing that innocent person, something along those lines. But the idea, I mean, actually there's a term for this, which is when you kill innocents and it causes a sense of terror. It's called hiraba in Islamic law. Hiraba. Haraba is when you kill. I mean, let me make this easy to understand. Let's say that someone kills me because they don't like that I'm from the University of Michigan. Okay? And we have a personal conflict, and he or she kills me. Okay, that's murder. That's wrong in Islamic law. Now, let's say he or she just so happens to be at the University of Michigan that day and decides to, you know, just to kill randomly. And I'm one of the people who's killed. Now, that would be considered haraba, not murder, but haraba in Islamic law, which could be translated as terrorism. The idea is when you have indiscriminate killing that leads to a sense of terror or fear, that constitutes the most severely punishable crime in Islamic law. And the punishment in the medieval period for Hiraba was crucifixion. And so the idea that one can go about killing innocents and causing a sense of fear, this was never debated, at least not on a sort of a massive scale as we find today. Now we find people actually debating this issue. And as we know, the first suicide bomber from the Muslim context was in the 1980s, when I believe it was Hezbollah in 1982 or 83. And now you suddenly begin to have all these suicide bombings. And, of course, we had 9/11 and other similar events. And, you know, one thing I will say, though, that is often overlooked. You know, Thomas Friedman in the New York Times writes, why aren't the Muslims condemning these attacks? Well, in point of fact, many, many were. And, in fact, in September of 2001, some of the most prominent scholars in the Muslim world were condemning it very vocally. The Grand Mufti, a Mufti is someone who delivers fatwas, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia denounced the attacks 4 days later publicly in Saudi Arabia. And this is the most important legal figure in Saudi Arabia. And you have prominent Egyptian scholars and other scholars condemning it as well. I know in the United States, Muslims were condemning it left and right, but it didn't seem to get that much attention. And so there's a lot of condemnation. There's a lot of condemnation, but ultimately we still find this phenomenon. And of course, you know, one can't explain it away just that easily because one, you know, if you look at Bin Laden, for example, if you read his fatwas, you know, he's citing Quranic verses. He's not making stuff up. He's citing Quranic verses. But at the same time, though, look at what how he frames his arguments. I mean, you know, he clearly has political grievances. He's not saying fight the United States because they're non-Muslim. He's saying fight the United States because, and he begins to list all these things. They, you know, they had these sanctions in Iraq. Look at how their support of Israel. I mean, he goes through and lists clearly what are clearly political grievances. And he's not saying let's go kill people in Sweden or Switzerland. Okay, so one shouldn't also ignore the political dimensions. But now you mention Iraq, where you have Muslims killing Muslims, and this is a very complex situation. And again, this seems to be, you know, it's very difficult for me to analyze, and I don't know why this is taking place. I don't know. It baffles. I'm confused.
Let me just add, this is Steve Shoemaker again, host for the program. Let me just add a little something from my perspective on this issue.
Thank you.
When I think of, yes, thank you for the question too. When I think of violence in the world, if you count the dead killed by violence, the last century was clearly the worst in world history. And it was mainly Christians killing Christians. I just remind us of that in this country where the majority of folks are Christian. But it was German Lutheran Christians killing French Catholics and French Protestants and English Church of England folks and eventually Americans of various religious, mainly Christian backgrounds. If you look at the last century, which has been called by historians the century of worlds of mass slaughter, the century of mass slaughter, very few of the people killed by violence proportionally were killed by Muslims.
And
that's as mysterious to me as you say.
Yeah. Well, let me just add to that. I mean, think about the First Crusades. Where the Crusaders entered Jerusalem and slaughtered many. These are supposedly the representatives of a faith that says, turn the other cheek. You know, so clearly people are going to do all kinds of horrible things, even if there's no real justification for it. And in the case of the Crusaders, I don't see how any Christian could justify that, given the texts.
And, of course, the Holocaust with 6 million Jews killed, these were not killed by Muslims. This is... In proportion, when we ask these kind of questions, we have to think. I think historically, we have another question here from our class. Let me just remind radio listeners: our guest today is Professor Mohammed Khalil. That's spelled K-H-I-A-L-I-L. from the University of Illinois, and he's speaking live to a class here at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on Islam, and class members are asking the questions, and this is being recorded for broadcast on WILL. Yes, we have another question.
Yeah, ordained bishop in the Christian faith. I just want to know, do you believe that 6 million Jews were actually killed?
Absolutely.
Do a lot of Muslims believe in it?
Do a lot of Muslims believe in it? That's another question. I certainly believe in it. And I know many Muslims believe in it. But I also know that there are many Muslims who deny that, and that's unfortunate. And I think that has a lot to do with a lot of the Jewish, because there you have, of course, a lot of Muslims who are Semitic, a lot of anti-Jewish sentiments that have, unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with politics to a certain extent. You know, the Palestinian-Israeli issue, but even that's no excuse. And I think ultimately, it's just anti-Jewish sentiment that leads to that denial, because you know, I mean, it's interesting to see how people will we'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Let me follow up, if I might, just quickly. There's a lot in the Christian New Testament that has been used, particularly from the Gospel of John, that can be interpreted very easily to be anti-Jewish. Are there similar problems in the Quran?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you find passages in the Quran that praise Jews and passages that criticize Jews. The most oft mentioned figure in the Quran is whom would you guess? Who would you guess is the most?
Moses.
That's right. Moses is mentioned more than Muhammad. Muhammad, by the way, only appears 4 times in the Quran. The name Muhammad. Moses appears more than any other figure in the Quran, followed by Jesus. And so Moses is a hero in the Quran, and there are verses in the Quran that praise Jews and Christians. For example, Surah 2, verse 62, and Surah 5, verse 69, both speak of Jews and Christians who are righteous, who will enter paradise. Now, of course, you get a lot of debate among Muslims, well, which Jews and Christians are we talking about? Before Muhammad, after Muhammad? In any case, you find passages like that. Now, you also have passages that criticize Jews. Passages that criticize the Jews who made a golden calf while Moses was away. Of course, we should say Israelites, not Jews. And then, of course, you have a reference. There's one reference to a particular group of Israelites and the Quran uses this term. It says that they were turned into apes, despised. Now, the Quran uses metaphors. Throughout. In fact, it says, you know, lower your wings. We clearly don't have wings. And so the Quran uses metaphors. And so some Muslims will say, look, these Jews are apes and pigs because of what the Quran says. And of course, that misses the very obvious problem that this is clearly referring to a specific group that had broken the Sabbath. And, you know, so the problem of overgeneralizing you know, this is something that if one wants to look at the Quran, they could easily do. The Quran critiques and praises Jews and Christians, but ultimately one realizes that in order to harmonize the praise and the criticism, you would have to adopt a more nuanced view or a nuanced assessment of what the Quran is saying about these groups.
Thank you very much. And we have another question from another class member.
Professor Khalil, I'm curious to know your personal views on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
and before you start in, let me just point out that we do have one guest who's coming, actually two guests who are coming in a couple weeks to talk just about that. But you can give us a little intro.
I think the problem of the Arab-Israeli conflict is fear on both sides. And fear is something that will motivate people to sometimes respond in ways that are in ways that are not ideal. And so I think that I actually would criticize both sides in some regards. I mean, clearly I'm opposed to suicide bombing, and I'm opposed to the things that we find being practiced by the Palestinian resistance. Specifically the suicide bombings. That I clearly have a problem with. On the other hand, I mean, what we saw recently, I would like to be convinced that there was a justification for it, the Gaza incursion, but I'm having a hard time. Maybe that's my own shortcomings. I just don't see it. That was actually, even from just a strategic standpoint, I would think it'd be better that was not the way to go. Because clearly everyone has the right to defend themselves. I'm not denying that. I just don't know if that was the best route to defend, And I say that, of course, recognizing that I'm in a very different context. I don't have missiles coming at me. But I just don't know from a strategic standpoint that was the best route to take.
Could we talk a little bit about, I think this is related to that. It may not seem so immediately, but could we talk a little bit about the understanding of within Islam of whether what happens is the will of God or not? Mm. Is everything that happens God's will?
Well, the Quran would certainly give that impression. And I think that there is certainly this idea that God's will may encompass things that may not be that may be harmful in some ways, or that may be. This of course leads into the larger problem of evil that philosophers have to deal with and theologians have to deal with. And the Quran, there's a verse in the Quran that says, "Seek refuge." This is actually in the second to last chapter of the Quran. It says, "Say, I seek refuge." I seek refuge with God from the harm that He created," which is interesting. I mean, the Quran is essentially it's saying He created harm. But so then the question becomes, well, why? And I think that the way the Quran deals with harm is, I mean, there's a passage that refers to Adam and Eve, of course. Many passages. And the story there, of course, as I'm sure all of you are familiar, is that they're in the garden and they're told not to approach something. We'll just say it's a tree. And then they approach it. So one could deduce from this, perhaps, that here you have this perfect scenario. They're in the garden and they're told just to do one thing and they can't even do that. And there's a verse in the Quran that says, "Do you really think you'll enter paradise without suffering loss of life, loss of wealth, and so on?" And there's this idea then that the purpose of this life is to grow. It's a period of growth, that you're going to encounter all kinds of challenges, all kinds of harms, and out of this you should grow and become, as the saying goes, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I know some would disagree with that, but that's a common expression. And I think many Muslims would adopt a similar approach, that there are all kinds of difficulties and challenges, and that's okay. We just have to sort of roll with the punches. That's, I think, the way that many Muslims approach that issue.
Is there a pacifist wing of Islam? But in Christianity, it's very small. There are a few Mennonites, there are a few Amish, sort of the radical wing of the Protestant Reformation. There are some Catholic groups that are very completely pacifist.
Yes.
But is there such a thing?
There are some, and their justification for adopting the pacifist approach is that, at least the group that I'm familiar with, is that it's a practical measure. That practically speaking, it makes sense for them to be pacifists. And to be honest with you, I don't remember where this group is located, but they're out there. Yeah. So they do exist.
And on the other side, within Christianity, for example, there are liberation theologians who look at people who are sunk in poverty and oppressed by their own governments, who say the concern of Christians for justice justifies violence to free people from oppression.
That is a very common thought. Yeah, that you'll find a lot of Muslims saying that. Okay. Absolutely.
And we have another class member with a question.
Professor Khalil, I'm so glad you're here. The question I have, and this may be a little sensitive, I apologize in advance.
I'm used to it.
Okay. Yeah. But I understand that the Quran is considered to have been the Word of God and come all the way down through the ages, but that in the 70s, I believe it was, in a mosque in Yemen, they discovered some old copies of the Quran and discovered that it was, in fact, there were many verses that were in conflict with what they considered the current version. So I wondered if you might comment on that.
Absolutely.
Controversy.
Yeah. So in the 70s, as you mentioned, they discovered these Quranic manuscripts in Yemen. And there was a very famous article published in the Atlantic Monthly about this. And it was authored by a man named Toby Lester, I believe. And I remember this was everyone was talking about this. This was what, 2099? I forget exactly when. Although, of course, the discovery was back in the 70s. And I remember one of the two individuals who had made that discovery came to visit the University of Michigan a few years later. And someone asked her, so how different are these Quran, these manuscripts from the ones we have today? She said, you know, they're actually very similar. I don't know what the big fuss is about. In point of fact, what we find with these manuscripts is that they're really very similar in terms of their skeletal structure. The way they used to write Quranic manuscripts in the very beginning was that they would write the words without dots, without vowel signs, at least generally speaking. There are some exceptions to that. And so the written text was really sort of like a mnemonic to help you remember. I mean, the Quran was preserved primarily through orality, through people memorizing and so on. And the written text was used more as a mnemonic more than anything else. And so these texts were skeletal Qurans. And they really, I mean, and Muslims have always known that there were skeletal, you know, Qurans. So that finding has actually proven to be a lot more hype than anything else. And a lot of scholars have been writing about this lately. And I'm not talking here about Muslims. I'm talking about non-Muslim scholars of Islam as well. And there was also, I mean, Muslims have always recognized that there are variants. But there are variants that usually do not affect the meaning. They're usually slight variants on the wording. For example, the very the opening chapter of the Quran, it says, "Ihdina as-sirat al-mustaqim," which means guide us to the straight path. A variant that's recorded, that's well known, is "Irshidna as-sirat al-mustaqim." It uses a different word, but it also means guide. Guide us to the straight path. So it's known that there have always been variants, but the variants typically are not, you know, nothing. It's not as if one version is saying, you know, there's a heaven and hell, the other one's saying there's not a heaven. You know, they're pretty congruous, even the variants. And so the finding in Yemen hasn't really proven to be anything other than really support for the Muslim narrative, because it shows that you have an earlier text that in many ways is congruous with the present text. And so I'm waiting for Toby Lester to write a follow-up in light of these recent discussions in the academic circles.
Mm-hmm. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with our guest from the University of Illinois Department of Religion and Islamic scholar, Mohammed Khalil. We are not accepting phone calls today because we have pre-recorded this program at a class at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on Islam. And we have a live audience here asking questions to our visiting scholar, and we have another question here.
Professor Khalil, I was interested in some of the variations throughout the world in Islam. We don't hear much in this class or in general about Muslims in, say, Java or Malaysia. I mean, and there are a lot of them. I mean, how do they relate to the rest of Islam, and particularly what's going on in the Middle East?
That's, you know, most, when people think of the Muslim world, the map is usually focused on the Middle East, whereas the largest Muslim country is Indonesia. And there's a certain extent to which the Muslim, you know, the Middle East kind of goes along with that. when you're in Egypt, you don't really hear too much about the discussions going on in Indonesia, for example, or Malaysia. And there's an extent to which what happens in Indonesia and Malaysia seems to be somewhat isolated. I mean, not just geographically, but also in other ways. And so I don't know why. You know, there's a very, I know I've been answering I don't know throughout this whole event. There's a very famous scholar named Malik ibn Anas, one of the most famous legal scholars in the history of Islam, and he's known for answering I don't know for more than half, you know, for, you know, most of the questions that he's asked. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to answer I don't know. It's a good question, but I, you know, it could be just a feature of the way the Middle East, the Middle Eastern Muslim countries conceive of Indonesia and Malaysia as this sort of distant, these distant lands. So.
And one could ask from another perspective, why do the news media in the United States think that a very small group of evangelical Christians speak for Christianity? But it's interesting who gets heard and who gets asked questions. We have another question.
I'm a humanist. I'm a feminist. I'm a non-practicing Jew. And you brought up about Judaism. I also don't, I'm not particularly comfortable with organized religion of any kind. I'm a bit confused. Here's what I think. Given that the Jews gave forth the concept of one God and gave birth to a man who Christians believe is the Messiah, hearing all of these degrading things that are written in both your holy books, I find so offensive. And I think it is not our fault that you did not come up with the original concept in the first place, if that's the problem. And a simple thank you would probably suffice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. it is interesting. Some people talk about the roots of conflicts being religious. Do Muslims talk about that too?
Oh sure, absolutely.
And we have two more here waiting for to make comments or questions. Go ahead.
You've mentioned that the Quran mentions Jesus, Abraham, Isaac, and so on. And also that the Quran follows the Torah and the New Testament. Is there overlap in the texts? That is, does the Quran quote from the Torah or the books that we call the New Testament?
So the what you find in the Quran will often parallel what we find in the Torah and in the New Testament, specifically the Gospels. And I would add the letter of James, and also the Psalms to some extent. In fact, the form of the Quran, I would compare it to the Psalms more than any other section of the Bible. In terms of the actual, like, you know, in terms of the actual stories, you will find a lot in common. You know, you'll find a lot of similarities, and you'll also find a lot of interesting differences. And the differences, what's interesting about them is that you'll often find them written in non-canonical texts. So, for example, there's a very famous saying in the Quran which says that if you, we ordain for the children of Israel that if you kill a person, a human, it's as if you killed all of humanity. And if you save a person, it's as if you saved all of humanity. That comes not from the Torah, but from the Talmud, if I'm not mistaken, or I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's a non-canonical Jewish text. And in terms of the stories of Jesus, you have all kinds of stories that, for example, him making a bird out of clay and the bird actually coming to life. You're not going to find this in the canonical Gospels. You'll find this in the non-canonical Gospels. So how do Muslims, regard this? Well, many Muslims would say, well, what the Quran is presenting is the original story. And the fact that they were found in non-canonical texts is just a fact of history, really. The other approach is to say that these are stories and legends and myths that were around, that were present during the era of Muhammad, and the Quran was presenting them not as history, but as myths from which we can derive lessons. So,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And we have another question for our guest, Professor Muhammad Khalil.
Thanks for coming. How common is it for believers of Islam to memorize the whole Quran?
Oh, very good question. It's actually, for those who study it, it's actually pretty easy. And, I mean, the size of the Quran, it's about four-fifths the size of the New Testament, and it's written in a way that's easy to memorize. I mean, let me recite the first chapter of the Quran in Arabic, and you can maybe hear what I mean. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. You can sort of see how it has a rhyme to it, has a rhythm to it, and that makes it easy to memorize. And so it's very common to find young children at the age of 7, 8 having memorized the entire Quran. And when they do, they're given the term title Hafiz. And it's actually very common. And actually, you'll find, you can even see this on YouTube. You can find clips of, you know, young 9-year-old or 10-year-olds at these Quran competitions where these older adults will open up just a random page of the Quran, begin reading. Then the child continues. And then they'll tell you which part of the Quran that's in, when this was revealed, that kind of thing. So it's actually very common. Now, in the olden days, you were given the title Hafiz if you memorized not just the Quran, but the Quran and all the collections of hadiths or sayings and actions of the Prophet, which that's actually very impressive. we're talking here about thousands upon thousands of reports. So memorizing the Quran is actually has been common, and it remains very common.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Since, as we just heard, those who memorize and recite the Quran, it's almost a song, and yet in Islam, there's not much appreciation for music in worship. Why is that?
So when they recite the Quran, it is musical. You're right. But they won't typically say it's music. And I think that has to do more with that's an issue of terminology more than anything else. Because there's a big debate among Muslims as to whether musical instruments, for example, are allowed in the first place. And this might sound shocking. Most Muslims would say it is acceptable. The instruments are acceptable. And most Muslims, I don't know. I mean, the overwhelming majority of Muslims I've met in my life would have no problem at all with music. But there's a minority of Muslims who, particularly those of the Wahhabi school of thought, which is popular in Saudi Arabia and other places. And among these Muslims, I find that they tend to adopt the view that it's prohibited. The musical instruments are prohibited. And they base this opinion on certain sayings of the Prophet that are pretty controversial because the view of the majority is that he made those comments in the context of critiquing a particular culture where you have, for example, these sort of like a nightclub scene with people getting drunk and engaging in all kinds of erotic behavior with music as part of that context. And so you'll find, I mean, the most prominent Muslim scholars today will say that there's nothing wrong with music. It's just, you know, it depends on which kind of music you're talking about. If it's music that's motivating you to go kill someone or, you know, something, to do something immoral, that would be a problem. But if it's music that is simply music, then there's nothing wrong with that. And actually, you find a lot of Muslims, mystics especially, who will use music as in their acts of remembrance and remembering God. But in the actual worship, if you go to a local mosque, you are not going to see any musical instruments. That's just, and I don't think you will anytime soon.
We're getting down to our last few minutes. I may have to cut this off, but let's go. We'll have as many questions as we can. Go ahead.
I have two questions regarding education. We understand about the madrasas, etc. Do students study other religions as we are here trying to learn about yours? And do they study the Bible to learn? And you suggest that those who only are fluent in Arabic can understand the Quran. Well, there aren't many people in the United States, so how do we learn in a broader way if we can't read a text that is only done in Arabic.
Yes. Let me go back then. Let me rewind 50 minutes ago and say, and add this to my answer, that one can understand the gist of the Quran with any English translation. That's fine. I guess I'm thinking more about sort of specific. I mean, if you look at a controversial verse in the Quran and you just limit yourself to that, to a translation, that's where I see red. Now, as far as education goes, madrasa. So first of all, madrasa just means school in Arabic. That's all that it means, school. And today, when we hear about the madrasa, as they pronounce it in the media and so on, they're referring to a particular school that maybe, you know, where students learn fundamentalist ideas or something along those lines. I mean, really, most madrasas are places where people just learn the Quran, and they don't really get into politics. And usually what students will do is they'll go to a madrasa to learn the Quran and then maybe go to a regular public school for the rest of their education. Now, others won't. Others will just limit themselves to the madrasa. It all depends on context. And as far as learning other religions, again, that depends on context too. In some contexts, they will. In other contexts, they won't. And where they do learn about other religions, it could be superficial or it could be serious. It's difficult to generalize. Yeah. Thank you.
And we are going to try to sneak in one more question.
Oh boy. In 11th and 12th century Spain, there was a time when Jews and Muslims, and to a lesser extent, Christians, lived side by side in peace. I wondered if, in particular, the philosopher Averroes, who was a Muslim who was highly regarded by, I think, all three at the time, is still respected in the Muslim world today.
Yes and no. It depends. I mean, there are some Muslims who are anti-philosophers, not just philosophers in the way we use it, but the philosopher. There was a medieval group of Muslim thinkers called the philosophers who adopted an alternative view of life, where God is not this personal God, but an impersonal force that doesn't create but emanates. And so Averroes is seen as being part of that. And I think we're out of time.
We are out of time, and thank you very much, Professor Mohammed Khalil, for being with us. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Ralph Martiri, talking about educational funding reform. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
On a remote high desert mountaintop in eastern Nevada, they're building a clock, a monument-sized, all-mechanical clock that will run for 10,000 years. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll FaceTime. We'll talk with the engineer of the clock of the Long Now. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This evening at 7. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners. Fertile. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Okay, I've been happily gabbing away with Harold Wilshinsky.